All right, everybody, Happy New Year. And you're asking, Happy New Year? It's not January 1st, but it is Rosh Hashanah, so Happy New Year to all my Jewish friends out there. Jews have been a huge part of the story of Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania. Lucky to have them as neighbors and friends. And episode 71, here we are at the far middle, and we're at the close of September, going into October. I've said it many times in the past that this is the sweet spot for sports on the calendar. You got baseball playoffs that are looming. You got hockey and basketball starting up. Football, of course, is in full swing. That's true on Fridays with high school, college on Saturdays, and then pro football on Sundays, of course. And then you throw in a boxing match or so on a Saturday night here and there, and you've got a great weekend of sports. So with all that in mind, and with that sports smorgasbord, let's go with a liberal application of dedications for episode 71. And remember, constant listeners, liberal is good, while leftist, that's bad. There's a difference, and America needs to wake up to that difference. The sooner, the better. Anyway, I'm proposing a trio of dedications for 71 from three of the major sports that are now either coming into their playoff era or basically starting up and in full swing. So first dedication is going to go to the 1971 Pittsburgh Pirates, who became world champions by vanquishing a loaded Baltimore Orioles team in seven games. This was the World Series where the great Roberto Clemente tore the national spotlight from others who enjoyed it in prior years, like the Mickey Mantles and the Willie Mays, because they were in bigger market cities. And then he took that spotlight and shined that light on himself. So World Series MVP, Clemente, he did all that series. He performed with the bat, the field, and his glove, running the bases, just an all-around great performance, a performance for the ages for sure. Second dedication is going to go to the great Merlin Olsen. Now, he's a number 71, at least he was in college, okay? He's 74 in the pros with the Rams, but a cornerstone, of course, with the great defensive line in football lore that's known as the fearsome foursome. He played alongside the always entertaining and dominating Deacon Jones, and also alongside Lamar Lundy and Rosie Grier. Olsen played 15 years, all with the Rams, made it to the Pro Bowl 14 of those 15 years. He won the Outland Trophy at Utah State in college. So again, he was a great college player as a number 71 before he made it to the Rams. Two of his brothers also played in the NFL. So not sure you see too many sort of trios of siblings that are performing on a pro level in a sport like football, but the Olsons were certainly one of them. And of course, Merlin Olsen became a noted actor after his playing days. A lot of people remember him from Little House on the Prairie. I remember him most and loved him most as an announcer of pro football and college games on NBC. So a leader, big-hearted guy, multi-talented Merlin Olsen. The third and final dedication for episode 71 is going to go to the great Evgeny Malkin of the Pittsburgh Penguins in the NHL, affectionately known in these parts as Geno. He's a man of few words, but one who, when he is on, he is one of the most dominant players you ever see on the ice. He won a few cups, three to be exact, and it looks like he's going to retire a Penguin along with his co-players Crosby, Sidney Crosby, and Chris Letang, now that he signed an extension, Malkin did, in the offseason along with Letang. So now that we got our first sort of trio of dedications for an episode in the books, let's get into the details and the issues this time through. And of course, the far middle is all about the connections. So Evgeny Malkin is Russian, of course, and Russia is very much in the news these days, none of it in a good way. I saw a few stories the past few weeks that I think is amazing and that no one seems to have been picking this up or reporting on it. So we'll use the far middle to be an opportunity to highlight it for you. And the issue pertains to executives at major Russian corporations in the industrial and energy industries and what's happening to these executives. So just sort of consider the tally so far this year. Now, the most recent that I saw was the chairman of Lukoil, the Russian energy giant. Lukoil was one of the few Russian corporations that publicly called for an end to Russia's war in the Ukraine. So this, of course, is a big no-no in Putin's Russia. So the chairman, he suffers a heart attack. He's sent to a Moscow hospital. And a few days later, it's reported, he falls out of a sixth-floor window and dies. That seems awfully strange. But that was just the most recent when it comes to odd deaths of Russian corporate executives. Lukoil found another one of its executives dead at home a few months prior. No clear cause of death, but it was reported he had drugs in his system. A Gazprom executive was found dead at home earlier this year, along with an alleged suicide note. That's the same Gazprom that is the energy giant that's spending a lot of time on maintenance on those pipelines to Europe these days. A former vice president from Gazprom Bank was found dead at his house this year, and it's alleged he killed himself along with his wife and daughter, so sort of a murder-suicide. And these deaths stretch beyond the borders of Russia itself. These aren't just occurring within Russia. Earlier this year, the former deputy chair of Novatek was found dead in Barcelona, along with his wife and daughter, again, looking like another murder-suicide. So I know that in America, the corporate world can be rough and tumble at times for sure, but I suppose everything is relative these days. Russian corporate life is setting a new bar for what rough and tumble means. It's literally becoming life and death. Now, as the Russian aggression that was enabled from the West's inept energy policies takes its toll in all kinds of unanticipated arenas, like corporate executive leadership that we just covered, it brings us to the next topic to connect to, which is what is going on with EU energy policy as bureaucrats, the ones who created this entire global mess, they're now panicking to get a hold of a grid and energy network that is falling apart and destroying entire economies from the UK to France to Germany to Eastern Europe, all across the continent of Europe and the UK. And we know bureaucrats typically will run from accountability or avoid to admitting mistake, even if admitting a mistake is going to repair a current crisis. So instead of admitting a mea culpa on these energy policies and accords and climate regulations that need to be readdressed, and the things like natural gas, they need to be embraced instead of admitting that, what do we see occurring by the EU elite when it comes to their wrecked energy infrastructure and crumbling economies? Well, generally, it can be summed up as making things worse. The European Commission is thinking about fixing skyrocketing power prices by, yep, you guessed it, mandating decreased demand and capping prices for power. The things that failed for decades and all across the planet are once again being hailed as smart moves by the elite. Now, this gets interesting and ironic because when you cap power prices, you basically reduce what lower cost power in the portfolio receives. So under normal dispatch and power pools in Europe, all generation receives the price of the last unit to come on, or the most expensive. So more efficient sources of power make the most margins, and it's the same way for commodity markets for materials that you typically see. Now, these expert regulators, they want to cap the price for non-natural gas forms of power generation, which will lower the blended price of power, but it will make things like wind and solar unprofitable. And therein lies the upcoming freakout of the left, the environmental movement, and bureaucrats all over Europe. If you want to have the state intervene and lower or cap power prices for consumers, then it's going to come out of not Putin's pocket, but instead out of those heavily subsidized wind and solar farms all over Europe. And then that means there won't be those returns for those multi-billion euro corporations that threw capital at the projects because of the subsidy and the tax credits and the protected markets and the rent seeking. Ironic, don't you think? But, you know, the regulators don't stop there with the ridiculous measures that are battling one another. There's also the thought that the state should start paying industrial or commercial users of power to not use the power by basically shutting down. So a lobbyist for European utilities, not the most dynamic or efficient of industries, and one that relies entirely on state support and protection, mind you, the lobbyist said that this reducing of power demand is no regret. Yeah, no regret. Except for collapsing GDP and shuttering economies and driving up unemployment and stoking inflation further as supply of goods are throttled from those closures. Today, the EU bureaucrat is engaged in an expensive game of spy versus spy. Remember that cartoon? Except it's intervention versus intervention in this case. Regulations were set to feed subsidy to wind and solar and hurt domestic natural gas in Europe. That enabled Putin with his gifted energy leverage on the geopolitical stage. That set the stage for invasion and for energy insecurity and for inflation and for the power grid going bonkers on prices. So the bureaucrat sets new regs and intervention to fight the old regs and intervention. Cap power prices, reduce them by lowering the price received by wind and solar, since you can't make Putin lower the price of natural gas, and thus natural gas-fired power generation, and then watch the subsidy seeker throw fits, or force demand cutoffs to industrial or commercial or consumer users and observe a crumbling economy and GDP. Like the cartoon Spy versus Spy and Intervention versus Intervention, everyone ends up a loser. The Ministry and Minister of Industry and Trade for the Czech Republic had a scary and at the same time comical quote on Twitter. He said, "We must fix the energy market. We must fix the energy market." My goodness, isn't it obvious the government already fixed things enough when they created the current mess? And another interesting side note to this state's continued bungling of making crises and then worsening them is how the press and the media presents them. Lots of headlines about tweaks. That's the sort of the term I saw in these headlines, a tweak to energy pricing. And plans that are, the tagline I keep hearing is under consideration. Come on. These are far from tweaks. It's outright state intervention and control of a fundamental market that's failed, and now we see the perpetrators doubling down with a heavy-handed ineptitude. Like the great Thomas Sowell says, there are no silver bullets in things like markets, only trade-offs. And now the EU is learning it needs to pick between climate goals that kill domestic natural gas on the continent, a strong and reliable grid, insane power prices and inflation brought on by energy insecurity, and subsidized wind and solar in their state-gifted margins in a controlled power market. All this goes to show is that state intervention is typically not good for consumers or reliability or GDP or national security, and the cure of more state intervention will only make the symptoms worse. Function demands a free market and a thriving natural gas market. Dysfunction, it's a sure thing with heavy-handed state intervention, as we have and we will continue to see. By the way, on a quick and related connection, did you see Elon Musk was talking about how the world needs more oil and natural gas? You don't suppose. I sort of like Elon Musk, but this is him, I think, playing Captain Obvious to a certain degree. But maybe some of those impressionable Tesla and Musk apostles will now be influenced and awakened to the reality of physics on this planet and how energy and activity basically gets done and gets powered. And I saw that Musk left California for Texas. And one of the reasons is the California dreaming in 2022, it ain't what the mamas and papas envisioned when they wrote their hit in the 1960s. Instead, California dreaming in 2022, it equates to basically a nightmare. So the governor, he outlaws the sale of gasoline-powered cars in the coming years. He does a victory lap and beats his chest about it. And then a few days later, the same governor is asking residents to not plug in their electric vehicles due to a heat wave, which you get in summer. And that's driving power demand to levels that unreliable wind and solar that are basically concentrated in the California grid can't deliver on. So pay attention, constant listeners, because California's energy insanity, it could be coming to your hometown soon. Now, all this regulator and bureaucrat talk on the energy and climate fronts gets me thinking about our next topic to connect to, which is how the expert class, whether it's in government or academia, sometimes take the normal person for a fool, someone who can be dismissively duped. You just don't see it in energy in Europe. You see it with COVID and the truths and myths of pandemic management, and you see it in the United States. Johns Hopkins, it's about as elite as it gets in academia and medical research. Well, Johns Hopkins has what it calls the Coronavirus Resource Center, which you can access on the web. And if you get a chance, give that site a look and check out in particular the death rate per 100,000 citizens of different nations that Johns Hopkins posts on their website. It's beyond ridiculous. Why is it beyond ridiculous? Well, the United States on this site comes in at over 300 COVID fatalities per 100,000 citizens, basically near the top of the global list or one of the worst. China, and where do they clock in at? At one, as in one death per 100,000 citizens. Now, you assess and look at these data, and the inference is that China is over 300 times more efficient and effective at managing COVID and deaths than what the United States has been or was. And by the way, the only nation I saw lower than China's one per 100,000 citizens, one death per 100,000 citizens, was North Korea, if that tells you anything. Now, Johns Hopkins covers itself on that site by tritely stating that differences in mortality numbers can be caused by a number of different factors, ranging from the number of people tested and demographics, you know, as it relates to older populations, the quality of the healthcare system, and so on. But these disclaimers would make the U.S. look to be in even worse shape if you think about them just generally. Oh, and wait, the last thing the site points out is other factors, many of which remain unknown. That's the phraseology they used. Really? How about governments that tend to lie about health and economic and military and human rights and technology pilfering issues, like perhaps China? You think they might not be reporting accurate COVID deaths? You think Johns Hopkins could do a better job pointing this out on their website? So these data from the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, they're so misleading that we're better off not even looking at them. Remember, you know, misleading can be worse than useless. Not being informed sometimes is better than being misinformed. Hey, any person you pull off the street and ask, would you rather be in China or the United States during pandemic, from a fatality and from a healthcare perspective? You know the answer. But go to an elite academic institution's website with all the official-looking data constructed by PhDs, and you would deduce and think the exact opposite. I'll put my money on the common-sense normal person. All right, so what have we been talking about? State intervention, elites dictating life for everybody else, the demise of the individual, free markets being shackled. You put all this together, it's pretty dystopian stuff. Let's take a few minutes to talk about a dystopian novel and a classic. You know I'm a big fan, if you listen to prior episodes, of the great George Orwell. In 1984, his novel, it's about as good as it gets when it comes to someone from the past being able to paint a bleak but inaccurate future that looks more and more like what 2022 in the Western world is turning out to be today. But there just might be one better than Orwell in 1984. And that would be Aldous Huxley and his book, his classic, Brave New World. Don't know if you read Brave New World, but I encourage you to give it a read or a reread if it's been a while. I wrote a commentary on this classic that you can read on nickdeolias.com when you get a chance. I'd encourage you to do so. But the author himself, Huxley, who was English, ironically, despite his ability to see into the future, he was blinded for nearly 2 years when he was a teenager from an eye infection. And that ailment basically created eyesight problems for him throughout his entire life. And despite that ailment and his lingering poor eyesight, Huxley managed to produce a dystopian classic that was a very precise, accurate vision that was able to gaze 90 years into the future. So that masterpiece, Brave New World, it was frighteningly accurate in terms of looking at what modern society might be here in the 21st century. Now, he wrote the book in 1931, published it in 32, which was years before Orwell's 1984. So Brave New World predates 1984 easily by a wide margin. And interestingly, the dystopian worlds of these two classics, there's a lot of similarities that they share, but they also present some very sharp, very different contrasts between the two. So despite 1984's rightful acclaim, I might argue that Brave New World actually scores more direct hits when it comes to comparing our society to what Huxley was predicting or envisioning with society back in the early 1930s. Now, Brave New World envisions what type of society? Well, it's a society that is run by a global bureaucracy that practices what the first George Bush president would call a kinder, gentler form of totalitarianism. And there's a strict caste system in the Brave New World. There's elite alphas at the top, and then you go down through the different segments or strata of society. At the bottom are the lowly epsilons. Humans really aren't born anymore. Instead, they are manufactured in labs, and it's predetermined who they'll be and what they'll do and what their caste will be within society. And entertainment is sort of front and center in society to keep people, if nothing else, just aimlessly preoccupied. So entertainment and the games that are designed are very complicated. They're always changing, again, to keep people preoccupied and not thinking about things of substance. And there is a prevalent drug culture in the Brave New World. The drug Soma is used as basically a tool to numb the brains and train those in society. Train them to be what? Train them to be passive. Train them to be submissive. God no longer exists. In monogamy, it's been replaced with promiscuity. I gave a reread of Brave New World this past summer. And when I was reading it again, you know, I was able to sort of just going through the book, sort of link parallels between what Huxley was predicting in his dystopian world when he wrote it in 1931 versus what we're seeing in America and the West today in 2022. And the parallels I came up with were seven in total. I thought they were pretty interesting. And I go into more detail, as I said, on the commentary on the nickdeolius.com website. But I can summarize them here for this episode of The Far Middle. And the first parallel was how Huxley was illustrating the idea that leisure, that's constant but hollow, when you have that in a society, it doesn't lead to increased culture. So a popular saying in the Brave New World is, never put off till tomorrow the fun you can have today. So there were all kinds of games that were devised in society under Huxley's world. Obstacle golf was one of them in particular. The rules were always changing. You were encouraged to cheat. Self-cheating was something that was just accepted. And you know, the games were changing, the rules were changing, the complexity was being amped up, basically to keep people preoccupied. And you look at what's going on today, it sort of reminded me of instant gratification and how that's prevalent everywhere you look. And instant gratification is basically beating or superseding long-term achievement in today's culture. And we as Americans have obsessions on consumerism, that constant acquiring of more stuff, as George Carlin would often riff on with some of his stand-up routines. And if you just think of this exponential growth that we've seen in largely mindless entertainment, it could be gaming, it could be gambling, it could be virtual reality, and how basically everybody these days, right, you get a trophy, you don't keep score, and you know, you basically are encouraged to cheat until you're caught. That's sort of the culture that we've got. A second parallel I found that was obvious to me was Brave New World basically informs us how science is the enemy of the totalitarian state when left unhindered, and it has to be tightly controlled and distorted by the state so that it can become a useful instrument. So science was a crucial piece of the strategy in Huxley's world of keeping society in line, and scientific progress was purposely frozen with the advent of the world state. So science and the muzzling control of it, that's what you get in exchange. That's the price, so to speak, of stability in society. And you had colleges that were practicing science propaganda. You were taught to believe things because you were conditioned to believe them. And the culmination is it basically science becomes an orthodoxy, almost a religion. It's very step-by-step cookbook, and it's never challenged. It never evolves. And of course, the effort is managed by the state in this huge office building. I think the name of the institute was the Bureau of Propaganda and the College of Emotional Engineering. Again, how accurate was this guy in 1931 about where we are landing in 2022? So, you know, today's world, the mirrors are obvious there. Science, we've seen it today. It's morphing into political science. You don't see the scientific method anymore. Now it's the scientific consensus theory, which is a dangerous one, as we have discussed. You know, you're told that the science is settled. You're basically instructed to obey. If you dissent or you question the popular view or the consensus view on a matter in the university culture, what happens? You basically get shouted down. You get labeled a heretic and a denier. And what's interesting, this is a little bit of a different take that I had reading Brave New World versus what most of the literary critics view it as. You speak to a literary critic, they interpret Brave New World to warn of the dangers of science. That's the most popular interpretation of what he was saying, Huxley was saying there. I had a different takeaway. My takeaway was that it showed the danger of the state suppressing and commandeering science, which is a little bit different of a take. Huxley also did a great job in the book of showing how the system can institutionalize class. It can cement socioeconomic barriers. Individuals were basically hatched in a lab. They were manufactured in a lab, and the state determined what caste or level in society they would be assigned. And that was true from the elite alphas at the top all the way down to those low-ranking epsilons at the bottom. And babies weren't raised by parents, but instead they were raised by state conditioning centers. They were trained by crude Pavlovian methods to learn what to hate and what to dislike, which included books, among other things. And the ideal society in a book was described as having the proportions of an iceberg, where you had 1/9 of society at the top as the elite alphas, and then the remaining 8/9 were basically toiling below the waterline. Think about what's going on today. You see the same thing. Our public education system, especially in our major cities, it's guaranteeing more and more often that students are hard-pressed to realize their full potential. Self-determination is becoming a rarer and rarer thing in this world, unfortunately, and in our nation because of socioeconomic obstacles. And instead of the educational system really paying attention to science, math, and reading competencies, they're not looking at those things. Instead, what's the system focusing on? Dead in the minds of the students, create a subservient collective that thinks what it's told to think and it believes what it is told to believe. And those 1/9 of elites at the top, they are above the waterline. Those are the alphas. While the rest of the society that we see today is kept struggling below the waterline. Yeah, Huxley, he also reminded us of the perils of loveless sex and promiscuity. The saying in the book in his society was that everyone belongs to everyone else. So sex was pursued exclusively for physical pleasure. The idea of a relationship, a committed relationship, that was viewed as savage and backward. Children were taught erotic play at a young age. Things like monogamy, family, love, those were viewed not just as negative, but basically as pornographic. And the worst obscenity that you could utter in Huxley's world and his society was the word mother. It would cause complete revulsion if you were to speak it. Look at what's going on today, right? Families, marriage, never been under more stress and duress. Personal intimacy and love has been replaced by other things. And stuff that you used to learn in high school sex ed classes, they're now covered in all kinds of explicit detail in elementary schools. So, you know, the parallels today are sort of striking with that regard. Hey, another thing that Huxley did that was awesome was warning us what happens and what's awaiting society in a drug culture. So I mentioned this this miracle drug in his book that was called Soma, and it was administered to individuals from cradle to grave, from when they were, you know, very small to when they died. And by the way, you died, you were euthanized by the state promptly at age 60. So when you were 60, that was it. Workers were paid in Soma to feed their addiction. And it sort of was like a pro and con. It gave and it took. It gave by arresting the aging process, and it gave you an emotional high, and it softened depression during tough times. But that Soma, that drug, also it took by acting as a poison that killed the person over years of use, and it basically erased all individual thought and free will. If Huxley saw our society today and our modern versions of Soma, and how it afflicts the United States and Europe and the West, he'd be shocked. Social media might be our form of Soma today in many ways because it brings mass emotional addiction to everybody from adults to kids. But then, you know, you've got your physical addictions as well with heroin and fentanyl and crack and alcohol and marijuana, consumed legally, consumed illegally, depending on the substance, to create what? Physical addictions that cross all kinds of socioeconomic levels as people seek escape from whatever haunts them. So you see a lot of parallels there as well. And then two more awesome parallels that Huxley just nailed, 1931, fast forwarding to today. One, he really painted a society that shows what happens when you erase the individual and when the collective sort of reigns supreme, where free will, independent thought, they're gone, and what it's replacing it, totalitarian domination. So this sort of idea of imagination, your sense of self, those were viewed as dangerous things. And great works, great books were banned. That was true from the Bible to Shakespeare in Brave New World. And you had some popular slogans that were out there. One was, when the individual feels, the community reels. I thought that was a good one and pretty prevalent today. And another one is, everybody works for everyone else. Everyone works for everyone else. So basically, you look at what he foresaw to today's sort of political correctness culture, he just nailed it once again. The views of the state, they're streamed constantly to kids from all directions and across all different types of media so that it basically shapes their minds. Cancel culture today was sort of hit upon by Huxley when he wrote Brave New World, right? You got to tear down anything traditional that would make one think and challenge. So you see that what's going on with colleges and syllabuses and the leading classic works and what's going on with statues and leaders and from the past, historical leaders from the past. And then this issue of dissenters, they're not just simply ostracized, but they're attacked. Sometimes they're attacked on social media, right? And sometimes they're just attacked sort of in the public square. And meritocracy, attacked as unfair, it's replaced with what? This injustice of equal outcomes. The last parallel, the seventh one, hey, Huxley demonstrated that a dystopian society, it can be a result of an omnipotent and global totalitarian government. The world state in his world, in his book, the world state motto was community, identity, stability. And a world controller determined what information was allowed for public access and consumption, what science was acceptable, what books or works were to be locked up and forbidden. And I think in Huxley's world, he was pointing out that the state, that a government can figure out that social conditioning is a much more effective and lasting sort of method of application than something like brute force, if you're looking to control a population. What's going on today? Like, what are the parallels? You got global organizations and accords, and they make you wonder cumulatively if we Americans still live in a Republican democracy. It doesn't matter if it's the World Health Organization or the World Bank or the United Nations or the G20, but those institutions, in some ways, they have more control over Americans' quality of life and freedoms and pocketbooks and decision-making than the U.S. Congress does, which isn't the way that it's supposed to work. And that faceless, unelected bureaucrat who's buried within the administrative state, he or she holds more power than our elected president, again, which isn't the way it's supposed to be. Domestic regulations and international accords, yeah, they take away more of our liberty in 2022 than any legislature or statute has. Yeah, if you haven't read Brave New World, give it a read. If it's been a while, give it a reread. It just is so prevalent with the parallels that you can draw to today. It's almost scary. I'll leave you with one quote from the director of the World Order in the book. What did he say? He said, "The greater a man's talents, the greater his power to lead astray. Better for one to suffer than many be corrupted. Murder kills only the individual. And what is the individual? We can make more of them. Unorthodoxy threatens more than the life of the individual. It strikes at society itself." I think that's pretty telling as to where we're at in 2022 and many different corners and corridors of power that impact us each and every day. Okay, episode 72 in the month of October are up next, constant listeners. Till then, go easy on that pumpkin spice, and I will talk to you in a week.